Good morning. My name is Tommy Howe, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9, a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program for the listeners of FM 94.9 and San Diego and all of Southern California, from the beaches to the mountains to the desert. This is Tree Huggers International. Be careful and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. In the wake of the recent bout of wildfires here in Southern California, we'll be doing some shows in the near future about the dangers of overdevelopment here in Southern California, building into urban wild interface zones and canyons and mesas, adequate firefighting resources, carving defensible spaces, and the legacy of fire suppression in the backcountry. But this morning, we're going to focus on a less obvious and possibly more ominous threat facing us here in the Golden State, and that's earthquakes. Californians have an almost famously fatalistic attitude regarding the temblors that rattle our state from time to time, but we've actually been pretty lucky the past 100 years or so because we haven't had what is popularly described as a big one. We've had some good-sized medium ones, but while we're all grown up enough to realize California isn't going to literally fall into the sea, San Diegans, in particular, tend to live under the assumption that we're somehow immune from large, damaging earthquakes in our corner of the state. And earthquakes like the Long Beach quake of 1933, the Superstition Hills earthquakes of 1987, and the recent shakers in Anza and Lake Elsinore indicate we here in San Diego are probably a little more plugged into the seismic activity of the state than we realize. So, in the interest of public awareness and helping debunk San Diego's passive earthquake denial, we're joined by Dr. Patrick Abbott, Professor Emeritus at San Diego State University, author of numerous books and papers on the subject, and generally considered, along with Dr. Abbott's San Diego State colleague Tom Rockwell, an expert on seismic matters in Southern California. Dr. Abbott, welcome to Tree Huggers International. I am just thrilled to have you here this morning. Thank you.
I'm glad to be here.
There are a number of faults within, say, 100 miles of us here in San Diego that could cause a damaging earthquake, like the Imperial or the Elsinore or the San Jacinto faults. But what's the story with the Rose Canyon Fault? How is this tied into the overall geology of Southern California?
Well, you know, if we look at the overall geology of Southern California, stand back and look at the whole region as once. Of course, the San Andreas is the famous fault, and it's the dividing line between North America and then, you know, Los Angeles, San Diego, Baja California, all that whole other area out on Pacific Plate. But for something that's plates that are thousands of miles across, they don't just slide past each other cleanly like a knife cut, like the San Andreas takes all the motion. So what happens is there's a lot of tearing along the edge. And the faults you were just mentioning are all parallel to the San Andreas and all related to it. So as you stated, there's San Andreas out there on the east side of the Salton Sea. Then we come into the San Jacinto system and the Elsinore. The next one over is the Rose Canyon, and that strikes right through the heart of San Diego, but then they continue on offshore. There's the Coronado Banks Fault, which has lifted up the Coronado Islands. Next one out, the San Clemente Fault, which has lifted up San Clemente Island. Every one of these six faults can do a magnitude 6 or 7 earthquake, and those are the kinds of things we remember well from Northridge in 1994 and up in the Bay Area, Loma Prieta in 1989. We can have those kinds of earthquakes here in San Diego.
What's the path of the Rose Canyon through the city of San Diego? Is there a defined path?
There's most definitely a defined path. Now, they have to visualize a fault now. It's not just a simple line on the ground. It's a torn zone of earth. So we say Rose Canyon Fault, but it would be best to visualize maybe up to a half-mile wide zone that tearing occurs within it. So there are major faults and lesser faults. Now, for the Rose Canyon Fault, its southern end is more or less just south of the Coronado Bay Bridge. In other words, it doesn't go all the way to the end of San Diego Bay. On the other hand, if we follow it northward, it cuts across San... I'm going to do it regionally first. It cuts across all of San Diego, goes offshore in La Jolla, stays offshore, comes back onshore in Newport Beach, and runs on up to Inglewood. Now, up there in Los Angeles, on land, it's known as the Newport-Inglewood Fault. And the earthquake you mentioned, the 1933 Long Beach earthquake, that is the exact same fault, the exact same line that runs through San Diego, the Rose Canyon Fault.
And then those faults that lie offshore, they're responsible for the creation of the Coronado Islands, San Clemente Island further out in the Channel Islands?
Yes. Now let's think about those a second. Okay, the Coronado Islands we see all the time, or Isla Los Coronados, they're just south of the international border. San Clemente Island just offshore. But faults are not just straight lines. And if a fault has a bend or a kink in it, not only can one side maybe not slide easily past the other, but there's pressure or compression at the bend, and it can literally squeeze the land up. So, San Clemente Island, squeezed up along the fault. Coronado Islands, squeezed up along that fault. Now, let's do the Rose Canyon Fault in San Diego. The Rose Canyon Fault Zone pretty much swallows up, or let's just say Interstate 5 is built within the fault zone. But when, as you travel north, say from San Diego Bay up Interstate 5, if you take the turnoff, they used to call it Ardeth Road, they call it La Jolla Parkway now, you make that turnoff now to go basically west to the ocean, as sharp as that road turn is, the fault turns sharper west. In other words, it's coming up Interstate 5, but it doesn't even cross La Jolla Parkway. It takes a big sharp bend to the left, if you will, or west out of the ocean, and then it straightens out and goes more northward again. There's a bend in the fault, and the pushing at that bend warps the land upward, and that's Mount Soledad. And of course, land that has been warped or pushed upward is broken and fractured and tilted, and as we've just seen here recently, not very stable. It has landslides. Now, but let me, if I can go one step farther, for those who can mentally put themselves on Interstate 405, let's just keep driving northward up through the LA Basin. Same fault as the Rose Canyon Fault. But you know how when you're driving along Interstate 405 and you look to the west, you'll see, oh, there's Signal Hill, there's Dominguez Hill, Rosecrans Hill. Exact same thing as Mount Soledad. The same fault has the same kinds of bends and squeezes up these hills. Only one of them in San Diego, and they have half a dozen of them up in the Los Angeles region.
And so the only major event, the only major seismic event, damaging earthquake, I should say, that's happened since Europeans have been here along what's basically the Rose Canyon fault structure further north is the Long Beach earthquake in 1933. There's never been another sizable damaging event since then.
In terms of the European historic record, as you mentioned, which we could date from what, 1769, when Junipero Serra founded the first mission here in Alta California. So that's what, let's see, what, 231 and 7, 238 years. In 238 years, we haven't had a big one in San Diego. But, you know, that's that thing we all, geologists are always talking about, the difference between human time and geologic time. You know, if you take a fault that's 2 million years old, how often does it have to move to be active? If it moved once every 500 years and you're 2 million years old, that's a lot of movement. But we tend to, of course, compress it and measure it against our lifetime. You know, we take a century. You expect a lot of things to happen in a century. And if a century goes by and nothing happens, you tend to think of it as, you know, dead, nothing to worry about. Our mistake. The Earth is active on a much longer time scale than human existence.
Well, and I understand that the Rose Canyon is responsible for Mount Soledad with that bend to the west, if you will, just north of it. What are some other San Diego landmarks that the Rose Canyon is responsible for?
Well, you know, we were just discussing there right at the bend. Let's just visualize La Jolla Parkway there where the road's east-west and the land on the west side, the ocean side, is pushing against that bend and squeezing up. Well, how about mentally? How about if you just took a sheet of paper between your hands and you started pushing it? One part will start warping up. That could be Mount Soledad. But if you keep squeezing it, what happens? You get a down warp as well? Well, you do have a down warp there. It's filled with the ocean. It's called Mission Bay. And if you keep squeezing even farther, here comes up something else again. We call it Point Loma. So the coastal topography of San Diego that's so, you know, charming, part of the aesthetics, part of what makes the region so neat, Mount Soledad, Mission Bay, Point Loma, San Diego Bay, they are all caused by the Rose Canyon Fault. And when I say caused, I don't mean it past tense, because they are all being lifted up and or dropped down, respectively. In other words, the fault is still active, and the land is still rising and sinking under the pressures created by the moving fault, even though we haven't had a major earthquake in San Diego in historic times. And you know the way us geologists like to say things. We say, that earthquake might occur tonight. It might not be for another 150 years. We know what is going to happen. We just can't give you the timing kind of thing. We're used to it with the weatherman, but we're failures at that. And maybe we're not failures. Maybe it is that earthquakes are inherently unpredictable. It may simply be that as this material, the earth, builds up enough pressure to where it's going to snap and move, maybe it's not a predictable event. Maybe it does not give off precursors. Now, this is science. You know, hopefully somebody, some stroke of genius will occur and somebody will figure it out. We'll have short-term earthquake warning. But As it stands right now, we have no ability to do short-term warnings, even though we can tell you almost exactly what's going to happen, just not when.
Are there places where the Rose Canyon fault is exposed, or where a trench has been dug into it, where the geologic record of activity on that fault can be seen, where we might be able to see some kind of a pattern?
Well, you know, trenches have been dug, but they have been filled back up. So let me do that in two parts, if I can, right here. Trenches were dug. You mentioned earlier my colleague, Tom Rockwell, internationally famous earthquake geologist. And Tom, with a group of other people, Scott Lindvall and other folks, visualize going into the mouth of Rose Canyon there. If we were driving, say, past Mission Bay, just into Rose Canyon, there's one little bridge that goes right over there, right near Garnett, Balboa Avenue, over Santa Fe Street Bridge. And around one side is the San Diego Gas and Electric, their big staging area. Tom and Scott dug a trench across the active strand of the Rose Canyon Fault, which cuts across that SDG&E parking lot. By the way, that's a pretty good thing to do with an active fault, building an asphalt parking lot across it. You're not going to get too much damage from that. But anyway, when they trenched it down, and then the trick when you trench down is you try to find things that will show you offset. For example, visualize a little gully, say a foot across and a foot deep, and it's filled with gravels. Well, that's kind of a line, isn't it, as it runs down a hill. So they find one of those there, and then you find where the fault has cut it off. Then you start doing a lot more trenching. And when they did that, they found that little gully was offset 33 feet, and that was in 7,000 years. Well, is that an active fault? Most definitely.
That's significant, 33 feet in 7,000 years.
Now, that doesn't tell you how many events. I don't mean to imply the 33 feet all moved in one event.
No, that was the slow movement.
Or, well, it was probably several movements of, 3 to 8 feet apiece. And the heck of it was, that's a minimal record because the land excavating, the bulldozers had actually cut off the one end of the fault, so that 33 feet is a minimal number. It could be longer. Now, the other part of your question, where could a person go see it? You know, one very nice place that's always accessible and easy to see a fault is in Tecolote Canyon. When you just drive in Tecolote Canyon there, they have a park there with a rec center and a little science center and all. But when you first get there, on your right are baseball fields. And if you walk up, if you park in the first parking lot and walk up slope to the highest baseball field, walk around the chain link fence, just over the left center field portion of the outfield fence, the Rose Canyon Fault is exposed there. A sign was put up. And what you will see is maybe it's not dramatic. You know, what you see is if you don't look carefully, it's just a cliff of rocks. But when you stop and look at it, you say, well, wait a minute. The rocks here on the east side are different. There's two different rock bodies on the west side and a third rock body on the east side. And here's you can excavate out and see the line. That's the fault. And so it doesn't look deadly or it doesn't look threatening. But, I mean, you could put one foot on one side, one foot on the other, and if it just happened to be the time the fault moved, you could have a pretty exciting event there.
Quite a ride.
Quite a tear, yes.
So is it reasonable to say that we live in a dangerous place, or is a better attitude just being these are things that are inherent in the landscape here, and we just have to learn to live with them?
You know, the word's danger, it has a lot of negativity to it. You know, the last thing I want is anybody to feel scared or paranoid or have, lose sleep or any of those kinds of things. However, when you talk about being aware of the surroundings, a tree hugger philosophy, if you will, right? We're trying to embrace nature. We're trying to understand what this earth is that we live on. And we know that we're in an area here where the earth can tear and move along these faults and generate a lot of energy to meet earthquakes. Now, since we know what's going to happen, but we can't tell you when, there's simple things a person can do to make their home ready. I a lot of times make the analogy to your roof and rain. You don't sit and wait for the rain, to say it's going to rain tonight to go up on your roof and look at it. You patch your roof, you look at it, you realize you want to keep it waterproof. Well, you can kind of earthquake-proof a house too. A typical Southern California house, a typical wood-framed house, one two-story house is an excellent structure to withstand an earthquake in. Assuming you're not built on a bad spot like we saw some areas in Mount Soledad. I mean, if you're built on stable ground, as 98, 99% of the area is, and then if you don't do some silly things yourself And I mean things like, you know, hang a ceiling fan over your bed, or have a heavy china cabinet just leaning against the wall. Or you go out and you plant pine trees and eucalyptus trees right next to the house and have the branches and the limbs hanging over your house. What really is the problem in an earthquake? Things falling on you. Look around your house, inside and outside. Not with fear, not with panic, but look around and say, you know, if things really started shaking heavily, can I visualize anything that could fall on me? And when you see something, well, take down that tree or trim its limbs, bolt that china cabinet into the studs on the wall. In other words, fix things so they can't fall on you when the shaking starts. Then go about and live your life. No worries, no fears. I don't mean to sound silly with this, but you know, in an ideal situation, we would be prepared enough so that when the earth really did start shaking, you could kind of stop and pause and sort of enjoy it, if you will. You know what I mean? Enjoy the experience, you know, just say, wow, this is a unique experience, rather than have it be a moment of terror. The earth has its way of operating, and isn't that really the whole point? Isn't it to try to get in tune with the earth, to kind of have a sense of the earth and kind of flow along with it? And even when you get to the more extreme events, the heavy rainfall, the other kinds of things, you want to have prepared yourself where it's not going to hit you and harm you, and you can experience this thing, go, wow, look at this deluge, what a rainfall, who would have guessed, kind of a thing, rather than it being a life and death terror moment.
You know, there's some really great things written, like John Muir wrote in 1872 when there was a big earthquake in the Owens Valley, and it affected Yosemite too on the other side of the Sierras, and he wrote a great passage about just being marveled by what was going on. And of course, it was handy because nothing was falling on him at the moment too, but
I like what you're saying, because in other words, read John Muir, like you say, the 1872 Owens Valley earthquake, possibly the third largest earthquake in California history. But there's Muir reveling in it as the boulders come rolling down and trees are falling over and all that. He is enjoying that moment. So at the one time, let's keep the John Muir-like, you know, theory or feeling of the moment. The other way, you know, you can go to the things like a Home Depot or a Lowe's or to the county office of disaster preparedness, and you can find lots of brochures or going online looking for these things. The Seismic Safety Commission. Seismic Safety Commission up in Sacramento, they have lots of online or paper brochures about things to do to prepare your house before an earthquake. And, you know, these aren't bad things to do. I mean, you know, sometimes I wonder if that house that I say I own, if it owns me, because all the chores and all I do, well, this just put them on the list. Some of the times we're doing things, we're going to fix a lot of things and make them stronger for earthquakes. And, you know, by and large, it's not highly esoteric or incredibly difficult things. You know, like, for example, a wall is a vertical element, obviously, and a ceiling is a horizontal one. Horizontal and vertical ones don't shake the same in an earthquake. That's a weak point. Well, how about just a simple metal brace, a simple L brace, and you just simply bolt, add more strength to those things so the horizontal elements are tied together more strongly to the vertical. Now, I don't mean to go getting off onto a lot of the details of construction, but the main point is, when you're talking about things like a simple L-shaped piece of metal with two holes drilled on each side of it that you put screws into to help hold things together, see what I mean? You're not talking about you got to find some high-priced expert to be able to do this. It's simply trying to add strength and to give a house more ability to hang together, stay together, while it is being shaken during an earthquake.
Recognize some of those potential weak points in the structure you're in and try and address those.
And add a bit of strength, definitely.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International on FM 94.9. My name is Tommy Howe, and joining us this morning is San Diego State University Professor Emeritus Dr. Pat Abbott, and we're discussing earthquakes and seismic hazards in San Diego and Southern California. And we were talking about the Rose Canyon Fault. Let's talk about the Imperial Fault, which is to the east of us, around El Centro. And of course, that's sort of the southern part of the San Andreas Fault Zone, if I'm not mistaken. And the last time there was a sizable quake on there was in 1979. Is it possible we could have a larger event on that could affect San Diego too?
Well, most definitely. Now, to do the Imperial Fault, let's put it in perspective by considering the San Andreas first. Okay, now the San Andreas is almost 800 miles long. Go up to northernmost California there, Cape Mendocino. San Andreas Fault kind of comes down through those coastal counties, you know, down through Sonoma, Marin County, you know, passes through just offshore the San Francisco area, comes down through the Great Valley, comes all the way down along the east side of the Salton Sea, about three-quarters of the way down the east side of the Salton Sea, and then it stops. And, you know, it's hard, even for a lot of geologists, I'm ashamed to say. A lot of them, after they've drawn a fault for 800 miles, and they're so close to the Gulf of California, you'll see a lot of maps where they've just got to make that fault run into the ocean as if that somehow or other matters. But the fact of the matter is, faults begin, faults end. San Andreas Fault ends along the east side of the Salton Sea. Now, if you step over to the west, and in that step-over zone, if you can visualize the southern end of the Salton Sea, and if you haven't been there, may I recommend it? It's a wildlife refuge where they have a tremendous number of migratory birds and all there at that southern end. You also have little active volcanoes. You have some beautiful, if anybody would like to collect some obsidian, there's obsidian galore there that may be picked up. We're not talking about breaking any rules or doing something in a park. But we have active little volcanoes, all kinds of geothermal power plants there where they're pumping up hot water from the magma near the surface to generate electricity. And then on the other side of that is the Imperial Fault. Let me state that again. The end of the San Andreas, between the end of the San Andreas Fault, its south end, and the north end of the Imperial Fault, you have this big zone of active volcanoes and geothermal power for magma close to the surface. Now, there's the Earth's being pulled apart in that area, a spreading center in a plate tectonic sense. Now, the Imperial Fault then runs from there, say, let's just say from near the southwest corner of the Salton Sea, runs southerly, you know, past the El Central area, Calexico, Mexicali, you know, into Baja California a ways. You bring up the 1979 earthquake, which destroyed the big skyscraper in El Centro, which was, well, three stories high, but this is El Centro. So it destroyed that building. I don't mean it collapsed, but I mean in an engineering sense, you know, when it had enough structural cracks and failures that it couldn't be used. That's what I mean. It is destroyed in an engineering sense, luckily not in a catastrophic sense. Now, if we go back a little bit farther from 1979 to 1940, the entire Imperial Fault ruptured from end, south end to north end, from top to bottom. And so that was a much larger earthquake. But the good news on the Imperial Fault is its maximums are still only around 7. And I say only around 7 because think of the distance from there to San Diego. Now, let's reconsider the San Andreas Fault there on the east side of the Salton Sea. That could easily have a magnitude 8 earthquake. And remember, the difference between an 8 and a 7 is going to be like about 30 times stronger. Now, if we look at the San Andreas Fault as a whole, I'm going to roughly call them in thirds. The northern third, that's the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, where the ground moved horizontally 20 feet in the central area. If we look at the central third of the San Andreas Fault, that's the 1857 Fort Tejon earthquake, where in the southern Great Valley, the land surface moved as much as 30 feet offset horizontally. There's even neat things like a livestock corral split and offset by the fault, you know, in other words, to measure these things. Now, if we come down to the southern third, our third, you know, coming across Cajon Pass, through San Bernardino city limits, past Palm Springs, on down to the Salton Sea, that has not moved in historic time. Carrie C. up at Caltech, using the same kinds of trenching techniques, say, that Tom Rockwell did here on the Rose Canyon Fault in San Diego. Carrie says the last big earthquake on the southern San Andreas was around the year 1690. Now, let's not just be scientists for a second. Let's just look at the numbers. Here's the San Andreas Fault. Northern third moved 1906. Central, 1857. Southern, 1690. Is it unreasonable to suggest that we might be a little bit overdue down here and that it would be reasonable to expect a large earthquake there? Now, the San Andreas Fault, if it moved, say, for a third of that distance, I'm talking about from Cajon Pass, San Bernardino, Palm Springs, Salton Sea, if it moved a third of that distance, you know, it might be a 7.5 earthquake. If it moved two-thirds of that distance, if, you know, has the fault rupture was that long, you know, rupture two-thirds of that segment, we could be up to a 7.7 or 7.8. But if we went all the way from Cajon Pass down along the Salton Sea, we could be up to a magnitude 8. And straight-line distance, that's pretty close to San Diego. It gets us into another thing. Not everybody feels the same earthquake. Now, for something traveling from the Salton Sea to San Diego, there's the long period waves, the ones that maybe have 2 seconds between each wave, and then let's just take some short period waves, let's say a tenth of a second, say 10 per second. Well, it's just kind of like when you go running. If you go sprinting, if you're going your fastest, you don't run this far as when you slow down and jog, and then you run the long distance races. So the point that for seismic waves is the high energy ones tend to weaken in a shorter distance before they get to San Diego. But the long period ones still bring a lot of energy a long distance. long period seismic waves, 1 second between them, 2 seconds, 3 seconds between the individual waves. Buildings have frequencies. So what buildings in San Diego would be shaken most severely by a San Andreas fault earthquake? And that would be, well, if you visualize a house, a one-story house, it can't go from side to, it doesn't take 3 seconds to go from side to side. It's going to do that in a tenth of a second. But if you take a downtown skyscraper, say, if you take a 20-story building, that might have a frequency of 2 seconds, and a 2-second long period seismic wave coming from the San Andreas Fault can make that building shake big time. Now, I'm not predicting catastrophe. I just said those would be the buildings that would resonate. The building would get in tune with the seismic waves, same periods of shaking. And those are the ones when, you know, the person who's working in that tall building comes home and describes how horrifying the earthquake was to the person who stayed at home. It's going to be like two different people talking to each other because they will have felt two very different intensities of shaking. And that gets us into another whole point about the kind of building you're in, the kind of ground you're on top of. There's a lot of other factors that come into play for how severely any building is tested or what any individual feels during an earthquake.
And a lot of that has to do with loose soils as compared to
hard rock, yes.
So there are some parts of San Diego, like, for example, we're in Mission Valley, and we felt a couple of earthquakes here before over the years.
Yeah, and we can think about that. We're in Mission Valley. San Diego River has the river valley goes down hundreds of feet deeper. With the glaciers advancing and retreating here during this ice age, the sea level was 400 feet lower just 11,000 years ago. And so Mission Valley would have been 400 feet lower. So as the sea level rises, what does the valley do? It backs up and fills with sand. So what are the buildings sitting on down here in Mission Valley? They're sitting on loose river sand saturated with water. Kind of like a bowl of jello. So when earthquake waves come in, you hear at FM 94, you get to experience more of an earthquake than folks in other areas do because you get that amplification, that jelly-like shaking added to the seismic energy itself. You get the additional, well, amplification is the scientific term. It's an everyday word as well, to amplify something. You amplify the shaking in loose water-saturated sediments.
Can you talk real quickly about the Elsinore Fault and this is just a personal question I have. Did that have any relation upon the Whittier Narrows earthquake in 87? Were those two fault areas related?
Yes. Now, the Elsinore Fault, that would be the second fault out from the San Andreas. Going to the east, coming in, it went San Andreas, San Jacinto, Elsinore. Now, the Elsinore Fault on a map, visualize Julian, visualize Lake Elsinore, draw a straight line between them, and you have a good portion of the fault right there. Banner Grade, where you go down from Julian, that narrow canyon that's excavated, eroded along the Elsinore Fault. Now visualize that, say, we're going to drive to Temecula Lake Elsinore area. We're here in San Diego. We're going up Interstate 15. We go up high. There's the immigration checkpoint. Then we drop down into the valley. And as you're driving along Interstate 15, on your left, on the west, there's a big, long barrier of cliffs right there. That's the fault. That's the difference where the fault is. Now, we've had tremendous urbanization there in that whole Temecula, Rancho California, Lake Elsinore, Murrieta area, and some of that development are on loose water-saturated sands, and you're right next to the Elsinore Fault, which had an earthquake around magnitude 7. If memory serves me correctly, that was in the year 1812, and so that is a huge fault. Now, you bring up Whittier Narrows from October 1987. The Elsinore Fault, as it runs north, it dies out, switches into another kinds of faults, a thrust fault, kind we haven't really discussed, one with more of a vertical motion. So the Elsinore is related to the Whittier Narrows Fault, the so-called Whittier Fault there on October 1st, 1987. They are not exactly like the same fault, but related. They're different kinds of deformation or responses to the regional stresses, and you know, they're right next to each other. One feeds into the other.
And then the San Jacinto Fault around Hemet, and that creates a side of the San Jacinto Mountains. I'd read that the last time there was a sizable event there was 1899.
Up in the northern part of that, that's so. Now, in the southern part, it's been very, very active. You mentioned earlier about Superstition Hills earthquakes in 1987. San Jacinto is a fault zone with so many faults in it with different names, like the Superstition Hills Fault and all. That southern part of the San Jacinto Fault, and by that I'm talking about, you know, in the Borrego Springs, El Centro region, they've been having lots of large earthquakes, you know, 6.8, 7.1s. Those things have been popping off 1968, 1987. some of the most frequent ones. Big enough that everybody in San Diego feels them, but not big enough to cause any problems in San Diego. And up till now, there hasn't been that much development out near them. And what development there has been smaller, more regular houses. And as we already mentioned, typical Southern California houses are good places to be in an earthquake.
Dr. Abbott, I am so pleased you made it in today, and 30 minutes just flies right by. But we're going to have to wrap things up. But you are heading off to Antarctica.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about that for just a moment?
Well, it's what I'm trying to do these days is visit more of the world. I lecture on, you know, on things like why the Earth has ice ages, 41 active volcanoes in Antarctica, not widely recognized, plate tectonics. You think of the East Africa, the big rift valley with Mount Kilimanjaro, second biggest rift valley in the world, there in Antarctica. You don't get to see the valley. It's filled with ice, but you see Mount Erebus, the big active volcano. It's just like Kilimanjaro sticking out. So we go down there. We lecture on the ships. We get in Zodiacs, take people ashore. We're on field trips. And I say we. There's a polar historian, marine mammalogist, an ornithologist, and myself, geologist. Four of us professors plus eight naturalists. And these are trips for people who really want to walk on Antarctica, want to get up close and personal with penguins, sea whales, and basically experience Antarctica. You can go on that ship and you can hear me lecture, and part of my duties also be, I'll probably be the one who's on the pier, picks up your luggage and carries it to your cabins. It's a full service ship, I'll tell you.
Dr. Abbott, have a wonderful time on this trip, and we hope to catch up with you again sometime. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
I enjoyed it. I look forward to being back again.
Well, that's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International on FM 94.9. Huge thanks again to our guest, Dr. Patrick Abbott, Professor Emeritus at San Diego State University and noted geology expert, for joining us this morning and talking about regional seismic hazards and area earthquake faults. What a great conversation. The opinions and views expressed on Tree Huggers International do not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of the staff and management of FM 94.9 or Lincoln Financial Media. And as producer, I am solely responsible for this program's content. Questions, complaints, concerns, compliments, would love to hear from you. You can email me, Tommy Howe, at tommy@fm949sd.com. That's tommy@fm949sd.com. For more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the program, you can go to the official Tree Huggers International website at treehuggersintl.com. Check it out. We just got a new logo. That's www.treehuggersintl.com. New episodes and content will also be posted very shortly on a Tree Huggers International page at fm949sd.com. Again, this is Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International on FM 94.9. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 5:30 to talk more about natural science and environmental affairs in our corner of Southern California. Now get ready for another edition of Nina Blackwood's New Wave Nation. It is up next on FM 94.9. Have a great Sunday and a good week. Be well.